My passion is the fight for freedom. My father fought for him in World War II defending our country. Today, we are no longer fighting with guns. Instead, we are fighting an ideological battle for control of our country by contributing to causes that support your constitutional rights. I am Patriot Mobile.
That was a shooting gallery up there.
I could hear the tremble in his voice.
She suffered a fairly severe beating. The video is pretty graphic.
Justice for us seems almost impossible.
It's not fun to watch somebody die, and they knew she was in mortal peril.
They have not asked the hard questions. Why was the Capitol intentionally unsecure that day?
The FBI had information about security concerns before January 6th.
They're out for blood, and they're getting it. They appear to be winning.
Were the actions of the Capitol Police out of line? Were there violations in use of force?
Now I describe it as an inside job.
I'm ready to do whatever God calls me.
There's an old Chinese saying my ancestors learned before the Communist Party took over our country. The family is the essential unit of human society, and that you must have honor and defend your family. But it's not always easy to do.
When the regime gives the order, you have to kill.
My heart was pounding. I felt my body bouncing and twisting on the floor. They put numbers on our shoulders, then separated us into rows of even and odd numbers. I was number 9. My brother, he is still in prison. And my sister, she was sent to a labor camp without a trial. But there's one piece of evidence they haven't been able to destroy yet. I left everything behind. If I can't expose what they did to us, then all of our suffering would be for nothing.
Welcome to Chosen Generation with your host, Pastor Greg Young.
But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should shew forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light, which in time past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy.
And now, Chosen Generation, where no topic is off limits and everything is filtered through biblical glasses. And now, here's your host, Pastor Greg.
Look, I am for marriage between a man and a woman. I am for life from conception. I am for following the Bible, and I believe that our founders started this nation on biblical principles. I am in support of our military and believe that America should play a role in world security. I believe our Constitution was intended for a moral people and that the Bible contains the only true moral code. I believe we are all born sinners and that God in His grace and mercy sent His Son Jesus Christ to die for our sins, and that if we will confess our sins, He is just and righteous to forgive us our sins and cleanse us from all unrighteousness. I believe salvation is not just accomplished in a little prayer, but that it is found in how that transformation is lived out. Jesus is to be the Lord of our lives, and we should follow biblical precepts. This is not legalism or work. We may not fully agree. Know that I share what I share because I care. If you strongly disagree with these, and you can, if you choose, unfriend me. I do not say this in anger, but in love. I wish for you eyes to see and ears to hear that Jesus Christ is the only way to salvation, and that God, not man, gets to decide what is truth, life, and the way. God bless you. And good morning and welcome to the program. Great to have you with me. Thanks so much for being here. I know you have a choice in where you can listen each and every day. And I thank you for keeping it tuned here to Chosen Generation Radio and watching us on TECN TV and across all of our broadcast network. Well, I'm very excited to have my next guest with me. He is an economic expert. And, you know, we talk a lot about our debt. We talk about the amount of debt. As a matter of fact, Carolyn Kane and I talked quite extensively about that yesterday. And she has predicted a coming Texas apartment investment bubble that is probably about to burst. It's interesting because my wife and I were just talking about this the other night, that it seems as though people have jumped back into the same risky investments that brought us the crash of 2008. Only times 10, and there are more people that figured out how to make money out of it, but what it's about to do to our economy is something. And my next guest has some thoughts as to how we might be able to get through this without everybody, what's the saying, losing their shirt. Richard, welcome aboard. Richard Vegg joins me. Richard, thanks for being here.
It's such a privilege to be with you. Thank you.
Well, you know, there everybody talks about the huge debt. We got the big battle that's happening in the House with regards to determining who's going to be the Speaker of the House. And one of the major issues that brought McCarthy down was the omnibus and the debt and the amount of debt and the basically, you know, adding debt again. As a matter of fact, I just wrote, we've got a $40 million bond here locally on the ballot, and someone put together about a 3-minute video, basically saying, "Why are you guys going to do this? You're gonna, you know, you're gonna add $40 million to another $40 million that you just passed. That where did that go?" And we're, you know, I mean, I live in the county of Bandera. We're talking about 24,000 people. You know, $40 million to protect our schools, it seems quite excessive. You talk about personal debt. Talk to me about how these two or how these mix. Where's the flow over line, so to speak?
Well, thank you again for having me. And yeah, I mean, you're getting right to the point. And it really has been private sector debt that has brought us our woes over time. And private sector debt is a much larger amount than government debt. You know, right now, private sector debt in the United States is about $42 trillion as compared to government debt, which is $33 trillion. So it's by far the bigger number. That $40 trillion is pretty evenly divided between business debt at about $20 trillion and household debt, which is another $20 trillion. So the place we've gotten into trouble over time, including in 08, as you correctly alluded to, is rapid buildup in private sector debt.
why are we seeing this move towards so much debt? And when did we begin down that idea of, because I mean, I'm 61 and I know there's always been kind of that idea of, you know, other people's money and all of this kind of thought process, but where did that come from? And maybe why does that get us in trouble?
Well, the rise in debt has been with us forever. You know, we study this back 250 years in the United States, and the ratio of debt to the size of the economy continues to increase. And to illustrate that, let me talk about 1980 to the present. That's the period that I refer to as the Great Debt Explosion. In 1980, total debt, government plus business plus household, was about 125% of GDP. Today, it's 260% of GDP. It's more than doubled in just that 40-something year period. Debt grows because it. I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No. You're fine. No. You're about to answer the question of something. I was going to ask you why do we keep creating, you know, debt? Why are we dependent on debt for growth? I mean, coming out of the Great Depression, you know, we were really much more cash driven, right? I mean, we were more of a you know, yes, you invested and your investments grew, but you spent what you had. And if you didn't have it, then you saved to get it so you could spend it, or you invested in something that you thought was going to grow. I don't know. Where's that balance in that? And what role does, say, the idea of, you know, the stock market play in it?
Well, you're exactly right. Household debt, private sector debt has grown tremendously over the last couple of generations. Coming out of World War II, kind of the post-Depression World War II period, private sector debt in 1945 was only 35% of GDP. Today, it's 160 to 170% of GDP. So it's been a fivefold increase. A lot of that's mortgages. That's the biggest part of private sector debt. But a lot of it is folks financing, you know, large screen TVs and, you know,
boats and yeah, sure. Variety of issues. And medical, I assume, has to play a role in there somewhere, because the costs of medical have skyrocketed.
Absolutely. Healthcare. You know, healthcare expenses, and healthcare expenses are one of those areas that gets us into trouble. You know, the three main reasons that folks file for bankruptcy relates to, first, healthcare, unexpected healthcare expenses, unexpected job loss, and then, you know, a problem in the family, typically a divorce.
Which, again, that's something else that's relatively a new phenomenon when it comes to the old idea of no-fault divorce. And when I say new, I know to, you know, a good swath of my audience, they don't even know that there ever was such a thing as at-fault divorce, or that divorces were so rare, you know, probably going back 35 years at least. But if you, you know, were born in the 1960s, you initially were born during from 60s up through the mid 70s, during a time when the idea of divorce was really, it was almost as rare as cancer.
Well, and it's not just divorce, it's just family overall, you know, keeping families together, relying on families as a source of financial resilience, you know, has disappeared in large measure.
And part of that was, is that you had, you know, nowadays we find it odd, right? If parents are helping their kids to save for a home or get a home, you know, I think about the movie My Big Fat Greek Wedding, you know, that's almost looked at as like, that's weird. It's kind of odd. But in reality, that used to be how it was done, was is that your parents worked hard and but it was family, and then you came up alongside of that and you worked hard, you helped the family, and as a result of that you were helped, and then you established your family, and it was passed down generation to generation. Where'd we lose that?
Well, you're right. I mean, I'm writing a biography right now, about halfway through writing a biography on one of the earliest, the first banker in the United States. And I'm getting into the families of that era. That would have been 1776, 1780, 1790. It was not untypical to have 5 or 10 kids. The parents were deeply involved in, you know, the matchmaking. Because it mattered. It mattered to the financial health of the family, who you married. You know, if you were the father or the mother, you know, the folks that were going to take care of you were your children and their children.
Sure.
So, you know, there was much more. And today we have 30-something million adult Americans living alone. You know, it'd be hard to have gotten further away from that family idea than we've got.
So the destruction of family then plays a role in this whole issue of personal debt. I don't want to take. I'm not trying to take you too far off course here. But I'm just kind of. I mean, I think this is important for us to kind of dig around at what the root is.
Well, I certainly think financial resiliency has a lot to do with the family.
Okay.
You know, if you have debt and you get into trouble. You know, if you have a family to fall back on, that makes a big difference. And frankly, having a family to kind of prevent you from getting in trouble in the first place. So, yeah, families matter. And, that has been a radical change in society.
So what is this new path that will bring us out of the current debt situation? You started to talk about we're at, did you say 125%? Of gross GDP is the private debt number?
Yeah, well, it was 125 in 1980. It's 260% now.
My goodness. I mean, you know, I've heard people talk about, you know, that really the only way, because that's not sustainable for financial institutions. That's not sustainable. I mean, they have to balance those books against something, and if you look at all of the private property and even, you know, earning potential of everybody in the continental United States right now, we have more debt than we have either land worth or even potential people worth in this country right now. Am I overstating that?
Well, I think you're right if you stratify it by income level. The okay. Middle class is in, you know, a situation where for many people debts outweigh their assets. However, if you look at it in aggregate, the net worth of all households in the United States right now is $150 trillion. That's as compared to $40 trillion in private sector debt and about $20 trillion in household debt. The problem is this. Most of that is held by the top 10%. 70 to 80% of all household wealth boils down to two things, real estate and stocks. But 65% of all the real estate and stock in the world, in the country, excuse me, is owned by the top 10%. The bottom 60%, we get into this in the book quite a bit. The bottom 60%, that's 60%, only own 14% of the stocks and real estate in the country. So that's what's going on. And that division has only been increasing over the last, you know, several generations.
That's really, though, more of a matter of educating the percentage that's not engaged in those activities, right? Rather than, the leftist idea of, or the woke idea of redistribution of wealth?
You know, I think it's a lot of things. You know, I get into this in the book. You know, I'm certainly not advocating in the book any sorts of, you know, handouts or what have you. But I do think there are things that you can do that would make a difference. One of those, quite frankly, is job training. You know, let's put people in a position to make more income. You know, we've got millions of jobs in this country that go unfilled because we don't have folks properly technically trained. I'm talking about high-skilled jobs and construction and information technology and healthcare. Mm-hmm. And we have millions of folks that are underemployed because they didn't receive the relevant training. So, you know, that's one thing we talk about in the book. You know, another thing we talk about in the book is, you know, how about just providing additional tax incentives to folks in the middle class to acquiring real estate and stuff? You know, that's not to the disadvantage of anyone. That's, and since they hold so little to begin with, you can do almost anything you want there, and it won't have a material impact on overall government revenues. So, I mean, there's a few thoughtful things I think you can do to kind of change the trend.
What's the resistance? Why? I mean, are these really radically brand new ideas, or are they taking something that just it makes practical common sense? And to that point, what are the obstacles?
Well, you know, I don't know if you've been in Washington, D.C. lately.
No, thank you.
So I'm just up the road, and I spend a lot of time in D.C., and D.C. is a place where there's a million ideas going into the funnel and only one or two things coming out each year out of the funnel.
Yeah.
And most of those relate to things that I think, you know, maybe aren't that relevant or helpful to the middle class. I think that's been true for a long time. You know, and, you know, when there's one party that tends to focus more on the wealthy, there's another party that tends to focus more on the disenfranchised. And, you know, the folks in the middle don't get as much advocacy as I think they deserve.
Now, they're supposed to just be self-sufficient and figure it out for themselves, I guess.
I think you just summed it up well. And I think a lot of those folks sit there and say, think to themselves, when's somebody going to do something for me?
And so what would it be government-led, since it's private sector debt? Wouldn't it make sense then for private sector to come up with this kind of a solution and start to figure out, you know, maybe on a small scale, and then as you can scale up the application of these ideas?
Yeah, I think there's some of that. I know some spectacular private sector job training programs. I know one here close by that, you know, is, you know, a 4-month program in which folks learn programming and come out doubling or tripling their income. It's small scale. It's, you know, a few hundred people a year, and that's not going to get us where we need to get, but it's evidence that things can be done. I also think, I like to think outside the box a little bit. I think, you know, for example, in the area of student debt, which, you know, used to be about $250 billion in student debt. Now there's $1.8 trillion. And a lot of that were these loans for these diploma mills that didn't do anybody any good. And, you know, I don't agree with what was proposed here about forgiving all student debt, because there's a fundamental unfairness there. However, there are well-established programs where through military service, Peace Corps service, and other things,
yeah,
you can get some relief. And I would just say, let's expand that to let folks do qualified service for not-for-profit institutions. And if they did that over a certain number of years, they'd get some relief in their student debt. That's a win-win-win, you know. Community organizations get volunteer support, people with big student debt burdens, and there's 40 million of them, by the way, mm-hmm. that still have student loans, you know, get, you know, a path, they get hope that they can get out of their student debt. I think we can be creative in certain areas. And that's one where, you know, it'd take a little bit of regulatory help to get that done. But I think that's possible.
The paradox of debt, a new path to prosperity without crisis. We got about a minute left. Talk to me about what are the crises that were, because that, I mean, usually getting these kinds of things moving forward, changing this kind of course direction, you're talking about a new paradox, which is, that's a big deal. You know, that was, that's what killed the, Swiss watchmakers, was their inability to make a paradigm shift, and they lost out to Seiko. So talk to me about what is the bearing need, so to speak, the weight bearing on the need that's that could trigger, and obviously something's going to happen. You know, we talked about this yesterday. I mentioned to you on the lead in. About, you know, the housing bubble and people who have invested in these bundles once again, which are subprime bundles. They overpaid for, they got into the apartment business apparently here in Texas in big ways, overpaid, and now those values are imploding, and somewhere along the line that's all going to blow up. But what is the crisis, the debt crisis that you see? At what point does this get triggered and turn into, okay, now we're finally ready to make some changes?
Well, we saw it, as you rightly pointed out, in the 08 crisis, it was real estate lending run amok. We went from 5 trillion mortgages to 10 trillion mortgages in less than 5 years. It doubled. You know, a blind man could have seen it. Our regulators did not. By the way, so I think it is a buildup in a select category of lending. If you see a select category of lending grow very rapidly, you can almost be assured there's going to be credit problems, reversal, and what have you. Now, we study this pretty closely. I've seen several little pockets of problems. I don't see any huge pockets of problems in the U.S. at the moment. China's got huge problems.
Sure. Yep.
There's several countries where runaway, primarily real estate lending, is going to virtually destroy their economy. And China may well be one of those. It's probably already happening. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we have a couple of little areas that are smaller slices. You've pointed out one. Private placement lending is another. Equity-linked derivatives is another. Remember how credit default swaps bit us back in 08?
Sure.
You know, we've got equity linked derivatives have grown from like 4% to 20% of GDP. But it's the paradigm shift is to get the bankers, regulators, all of us to look at those buildups, which is something we simply have not done and did not do in the past as a way of preventing these crises going forward.
The paradox of debt, a new path to prosperity without crisis by Richard Vaeg, V-A-G-U. You can see the name of the book up on the screen under Richard's name. Richard, thanks for being with us today. It's going to be interesting. Hopefully there will be an openness to looking at some of these issues and changing direction, because falling off the cliff again would be quite devastating to us, I believe.
I'm so grateful to you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. All right, folks, we are going to take a break. We come back, we'll have some information about a very hot topic that's going on. I'm going to play for you an interview, and I'm putting this up for you right now. But this is an interview that I did with Miriam Hannon back in June of 2022. And it has to do with the George Floyd situation. Check out this trailer.
Freedom of speech, folks. got this all on camera. Watch out.
Don't touch me.
Third precinct is up in flames.
We begin with breaking news in South Minneapolis.
Caught on tape, a black man pinned to the ground, later dying after a white officer kneeled on his neck.
It started with a report of a forgery in progress and ended with Floyd's death.
The situation has become volatile at the 3rd Police Precinct tonight.
As police officers and protesters clash over a man's death.
Miles from Minneapolis, anger, frustration pouring into the streets of America.
I can't breathe!
It all stems from this video.
He can be heard on the video saying, I can't breathe.
Police officers involved have all been terminated.
I said, if we really want to know how he died, we need to call the medical examiner. And I've covered death and been to the medical examiner in Los Angeles. So anyway, I called the examiner and they told me that it would take weeks and weeks and weeks. And yet, literally hours later, CNN leaked these preliminary reports. We know to sow discord and to rile up the protests turn riots. So then also, I've been covering this in real time. And with these false flags and these psyops, you will witness in real time evidence being scrubbed, which is definitely the case. The next day, Bridget, a supposed sister, was doing Good Morning America. And I noticed that she was wearing a t-shirt that said, I can't breathe. And I'm like, huh, did you get to FedEx that overnight? Are print shops now essential? Because we were in lockdowns, right? And people were getting antsy.
Oh, man. I love the way you think. Okay, go ahead. That's awesome. So, that's so cool.
So I'm like, I did a research and I did I Can't Breathe, Benjamin Crump, and George Floyd.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I'm like, oh, my goodness. Oh, yeah. Eric Garner also said I can't
Trayvon, breathe. Yeah, Trayvon Martin's attorney. You bet.
Exactly. Who is an ambulance chasing shyster parading as a civil rights attorney who doesn't give a crap about BLM, Black Lives. And so that was another red flag. Then I interviewed Giovanni Thunstrom, and that must have been the 27th of May, who is his other employer. And I noticed these talking points, black against white. He said to me that he had been strangulated because, if you recall, there was water, liquid coming out from underneath the car. And I myself said, oh my goodness, did he pee on himself? Was that a, but in reality, it was from the exhaust from the car, but it was another trick. So I noticed these talking points that I noticed also in the public narrative that was released by the press statement. And then, of course, we, another thing is that no one was wearing masks the day of 25th. There was Thomas Lane and one bystander and one of the supposed EMTs. But the next day on the steps of City Hall, Jacob Fry, the Justin Trudeau knockoff, and was hosting in so quickly a presser, and everyone on the steps was wearing masks because they brought in the mask mandates as they ushered in their I Can't Breathe slogan. And I know that when I first wore my face diaper, what came to my mind was I can't effing breathe. So that was also part of their masking satanic ritual. And again, like I said, allowed us to go from virus to violence. And in reality, after 2 years of digging, what I believe is underneath it all is a money laundering operation involving fake fentanyl made from Chinese chemical precursors with the help of the Sinaloa and Mexican cartel. And that high up in the echelons, the government, it's almost a fallacy that the cartels are a danger. High up, I'm just reading a book now that is maybe just came out called The Cartels Do Not Exist, and that they use the cartels as the boogeyman when in fact they are in cahoots. And there was in January, I believe January 23rd, 2020, there were 900 $1 bills that were intercepted by the government state of Minnesota of fake bills. So I looked around to see if there was a counterfeiting problem. Now, if anyone really cared about this black man, we would be looking at the source of the fake cash, and we would be looking at the source of the fake drugs. But now, in 2022, with the Ministry of Truth and the gaslighting that we live with every single day, now the drugs are not even a consideration. And I'd like to add that in these false flag operations, I believe that they compartmentalize people. So they turn to be, they serve as useful idiots. In this case, I would even venture to say that it was used as a duty to intervene exercise. They admit in the federal trial that no one covered, that just occurred, of the three officers, that they were found guilty on duty to intervene. The
most because everybody was busy watching Johnny Depp and Amber Heard.
Oh, yes. Yes.
No, I'm serious. Oh, yes. Everybody was busy watching Johnny Depp and Amber Heard, so nobody was paying attention. Nobody paid attention to the Michael Sussman trial, and nobody paid any attention to that, and nobody's paying any attention to the proceedings that are happening regarding some of the January 6th defendants as well.
Absolutely, and no one's paying attention to Charles Lieber, who is the nanotech king, who is responsible for unleashing this Pandora's box of cyborg transhumanism inventions. So, you know, he was found to be a spy initially, and now he's about to walk away a free man while no one's paying attention. So, yes, there is just us, and the justice system is pathetic.
All right. We're coming into that break, but I don't want you to go anywhere. Here's what I'm going to tell you, folks. If you go over right now to chosengenerationradio.com, chosengenerationradio.com. Miriam, hopefully, is going to hang with me here for a few minutes to go into some of this stuff. And I'm telling you, you need to know truth, folks. Okay? I play a bit about, at the end of the day, how will I stand? This is about how you will stand at the end of the day. We're going to continue this over at chosengenerationradio.com. Okay, we are off the radio air, so now we are off terrestrial radio. At any rate, so let's continue this conversation.
Yes, and I want to get into, yeah, Derek. Given you're a military man, I would like to tell you about what I've discovered regarding Derek Chauvin.
Please. Yeah, so let's go ahead.
Are we on air?
We're ready. We're rocking. Oh, we're rolling.
Okay. All right. So in regards to Derek, it is very suspect for me in my 25 years plus as a real journalist that the government put out a 79-page personnel file. So when looking into this man, it seems like he's a two-dimensional character that's been activated for a mission. For no one to be willing to go on record to stand for him. I also discovered that he served, they talk about his two stints with the military. He was in Rochester, Minnesota, and he also was in Hovenfall, Germany, where they have military police. And I looked at this combative training center that specializes in force-on-force exercises, which is basically simulation training for the unexpected. On top of that, no one mentions that he went to Fort Benning in 2004, which means he was already an MPD cop and he was already working for El Nuevo Rodeo. And what did he do there? When I learned that Fort Benning also used to be referred to as the School of Assassins and was very instrumental in training Latin American military, including Manuel Noriega and other dictators. So what was he activated? Is this a way you treat a veteran? And how does a veteran go working, moonlighting at not only one nightclub, but people don't know he worked for yet another nightclub that also had ties to the Mexican
to the cartels.
Cartel.
Okay. I had heard about him and the connections between him, Floyd, cartels, drugs, that there was definitely and a woman that was involved, not relationally, but as an employer.
Maya Santa Maria,
okay,
is the front woman for El Nuevo Rodeo, which was housed in an iconic Oddfellows building, because there's also Freemasonic symbolism as we get a little bit more out there. As a journalist, I have to be able to cite everything that I say.
I'm glad you are. Yep. Yep.
Yes. And so if I.
No, I was in San Angelo, Texas, and you may be familiar with San Angelo. Do a little research. You'll find, yeah, Robert Stack, Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah.
San Angelo, Texas, Satanic Murders. And two young people who were assassinated at the lake there in San Angelo, and it ultimately led to the shutting down of the Masonic Temple in San Angelo.
Okay, I will look that up, and I know for the people that seems really out there, but I would like for people to consider the possibility that this was a sacrifice, and that possibly George Floyd took those drugs to enable what he signed up for ultimately. Oh, we'll make you Rodney 2.0. Just keep saying, I can't breathe. Now,
and he says, because in your video, I know you're probably going to get to this, but in your video, he makes a statement and he says, wait till you see what's going to happen when I, you know, when I can't breathe anymore or something.
So he says, when I stop breathing,
yes,
when I stop breathing, it's, yeah, going to go off on me, man.
Yeah.
And so that line,
yeah,
which I still play in my head as to what possibly, my publisher said that perhaps he was referring to his heart. Now, in this rendition of reality, their drugs are no longer a factor. Now, recently, I had the opportunity to have an exclusive interview with Maurice Lester Hall. Now, in my investigation and listening to the video hundreds of times, I suspected that Maurice was a snitch. Someone inside of Cup Foods said, "You're right, he is a big snitch." I applied for a FOIA document, and sure enough, in black and white, I now have proof that, in fact, for a hot minute, Maurice Lester Hall was an informant. Now, I did ask him this, and he said that he ultimately stopped cooperating with him, which is why they recirculated a lot of the charges. Now, Maurice was, do you know who that is, the person that was with him?
Yeah, that was the man, right? There was a man and a woman that were with him in the car. Yeah.
Yes. So okay. The media lies and says that they all meet there coincidentally. But in reality, I now possess footage that shows that Maurice and George arrived there together. And I know that they were there earlier that day. According to an insider of Cup Foods, I'm told that Maurice tried to buy an iPad with fake money. However, Maurice says that he had $7,000 of real money on him. I did not ask him where that real money came from. But if you look at his story, he escapes and doesn't make any qualms about escaping. He had outstanding warrants. I understand that nobody wants to go back into prison. And I would also say that, you know, drug addicts need to be rehabilitated, not in prison. But he was also a drug dealer. So he leaves to Texas and he gets caught as a fugitive out of state. Now, just this is me reading the docket. Then they drop all charges. They seal the case. And then next thing day on June 4th, he's doing Good Morning America. And he's found to have the beginnings of intellectual disability, which is AKA mental illness. So as all mentally ill drug dealing felons, they go on Good Morning America. So
and wait a minute, and write a book and make big dollars with endorsements, right? Or something.
Well, he had said that he was writing a book, but on the scene, he's not even able to spell out the name George. So I had these preconceived notions, but I have to say that we spent about 2 weeks, you know, preparing for this interview, and I really followed his lead, and I pulled, you can see the interview, I pulled clips that he wanted to show, because on George's proverbial symbolic deathbed, he says, "Reese, I love you." So this is my takeaway. Ultimately, he tells me that the Floyd family never met with Maurice. And he says, "Regardless of what you think of me, wouldn't you want to speak to the person who spent their last hours with your loved one?"
Right.
For me, it's a resounding yes. How about you, Pastor Greg?
Absolutely. 100%. I'd want to know everything there is. I mean, that's why I try to find people that were witnesses of the accident that I was in, because I want to know, what did they see? What was their impression? Not because I want to get anybody in trouble. I don't care about that. I want to piece it together in my head. What really happened that they saw?
When I was hit by an SUV, I tracked down the witnesses so that I could, as a journalist, piece back what happened. And I totally understand that. And so, you know, I found myself crying speaking to Maurice, because he was thrown under the bus. Wow. They basically told him they took away all the charges. But because he didn't fully cooperate, they've also taken his child away. He does not want to go back to a life of selling drugs. Nobody will give him a job. So, yeah, the Floyd family, out of the $47 million that they raised, I think should give a couple of thousand at least to Maurice and help him get his son back. And those are, you know, when you realize
$47 million.
So $27 million from a civil suit, which was the largest historically of its kind.
Oh, I think and I heard about least, that. Okay.
At least 14 on the compromised, corrupt GoFundMe site, which I've been banned on since 2018 as an OG censored journalist. So speaking to him and getting that, he did not admit to the drugs. I believe this brings up the fact that the players, they are useful idiots. They do not see the full scope of the ruse that's being carried out.
Saul Alinsky.
Because he is a victim of police brutality. They are overexerting their power, and he is a victim of racism. So how could he see through that bias? He's not able to. But I would, after hearing that nugget, did the family sign up to sacrifice? You know, early on, Maya, who is in charge of the Latin narrative because she owns Telemundo, she is also was sitting on the advisory board of the Super Bowl, which we know has ties to human trafficking.
Absolutely.
She's very influential. And early on, she speaks to Spanish media and she says he was a sacrifice. And she inserts the word literalmente. She says he was a literal sacrifice. And so what if you listen when I present this documentary, if you listen to all that George Floyd said and entertain the possibility that he took those drugs to be able to go through what he did. Now, possibly Derek, I would argue, was also thrown under the bus and was disposable and is also proverbially dead. He has no life. He's right. Also wanted for tax evasion, which is oftentimes seen in money laundering. And he was voting and had a residence in Florida because there's no state income tax. And like I said, he worked for another club with ties to the Mexican cartel. He was also a real estate agent. So when did this guy, he was a real estate agent, he lived in Florida, he had security off duty, when was he a cop? And he's also won many medals. So he was he is a yes man. He's had at least three fatalities. If he did get schooled at the School of Assassins, it's possible. I also interviewed Kathy O'Brien to ask her, is it possible that he was MK Ultra'd, that he was activated? Because his demeanor is usually very soft spoken and he's awkward. And also the fact that nobody went on record to stand for him. The only one person who spoke to me was a military, his sergeant, when he says Derek was 19, but according to my calculations, he would have been 23. So it's all very bizarre.
Now, there's a website, right? George Floyd Truth, something like that?
No, it's I have a givesendgo.com to raise funds to pay for my editor and all the footage I've purchased.
And that,
and there's also George Floyd Review.
That's it. That's the one. Okay. GeorgeFloydReview.org. Now, can they get to the GiveSendGo from there?
Yes, they can also pledge a donation for an advanced copy of the book if they want something in return, as opposed to just giving a donation. But to know, for instance, like Chase Bank shut down my bank account, and while it certainly could be for all the how vocal I've been against this jab, I believe someone who leaks information to me and was helping me when I was amassing, I did a series on the election. I was at January 6th and presented my footage to Rudy Giuliani. And so he was this guy I call Mr. X. He told me, do you know the connection between BLM and Chase? And so Chase is JP Morgan, Vanguard, Rothschild.
And now you're oh, there you go. Yeah. And now they're probably cyber attacking your stream to me.
Yeah.
Which would make sense. So that piece doesn't surprise me. But and I've talked about this, the folks, if you are at a national bank, a Chase, a Bank of America, a Wells Fargo, any of those are international banks. They're really part of an international cabal or a cartel, if you want to call it that.
Sure.
And you need to get your money out of those places and find a very local and locally owned and locally controlled bank, and they're getting harder to come by. I understand that, but you've got to get into one of those kinds of banks where you literally know the guys that own the place. Lime, I have some friends that have actually started taking up, it's called Lime Bank, Ronnie Beers and them. So that would be one you could consider. I bank locally. I'm not going to really talk about that. I don't want them to get attacked.
I need to get, well, they closed the bank account. They did eventually get my money out, but just to finish, JP Morgan, Chase Bank, Vanguard, Rothschild, and they invested quote unquote $30 billion to eradicate racism by investing in small business owned by minorities. So I call and I tell them, you know, last I checked, I'm kind of brown. So how come, you know, how about
what about me? Life? What about me? Yeah.
And they said they could not give me a reason as to why they canceled my bank account. But, you know, they don't want this story out, and you don't want to be messing with the Sinaloa cartel. And people have tapped out and they have fatigue, but I have not tapped out. And for whatever reason, God has chosen me to bring this story forth and cement it for the history books for anyone who wants to know about the truth. Now, sure, with false flags and psyops, you can get caught up in the placement of the smoke and mirrors.
Yes. And so the prayer is, Lord, let me have eyes to see and ears to hear that I don't get so deep, because the purpose of a psyop is to get you confused. It's to get you running down mouse trails. What? It's to get you off track from what's really going on. And there are so many trap doors that they work on to get you into, so that you'll run down to a dead end, get discouraged, or get yourself into an unsafe situation. And that's one of the reasons.
Absolutely.
Why.
And also, well,
it's one of the reasons, Miriam, why this sits underneath my desk here when I'm on air. And my gates are painted purple, which here in Texas is your singular warning. And when I don't have that, then I have this here sitting with me as well. I am fully armed here, as I do my show every day.
Yeah. And they have, I've been telling people who are targeted, and to tell the outside world, they might not understand, but they tailor their torture and their attacks to the person. It's personalized, and right. It's very subtle, and it's hard to share to another person. And now, yes, censorship has been normalized, but when they go after your ways of making money, and certainly my film, it's not like, who is this chick? No, I've directed and written and produced an award-winning film around that's been seen around the world. Right. And I mean business. So $15,000 is not a lot of money. Why has this been gated?
Such a problem.
And so no one, this is not, you know, even the conservative media that has perpetuated, for instance, that George Floyd put his gun up to a pregnant woman. Well, I spoke to the lawyer for George Floyd, and I've actually read the court document. There's nowhere that says that she was pregnant. Yes, he did put a gun up, but this is what I mean about, you know, broken telephone, parrots and prostitutes, and really paying attention to details. And if you look at the trailer, it's very subtle, and I've played it three times, but you can see from the camera, the milestone camera across the street from Cup Foods,
right,
that all the bystanders walk at one point in unison. When Tu Tao, the controller, he says he's a traffic controller, that was his job, turns around. And so I look then at his camera, and it's very subtle. And he makes a gesture with his hands, and then all the bystanders, the extras, so to speak, move. So, yes, not to get lost in the placement of the smoke and mirrors, but as a documentarian and as a journalist, that is part of the book. The book is called a multi-layered PSYOP exam.
I was just going to say, and so that what's on that site, that multi-layered PSYOP exam, that's the official trailer. Is that correct?
It's the official trailer. All right. Yes, the book is not completed.
Can I can I play that trailer for folks real quick?
Absolutely.
All right, here we go.
Can
we're
I
gonna
see it, or I won't see it. I don't have to see it.
Okay, but no, it's so here we go.
Precinct is up in flames.
We begin with breaking news in South Minneapolis.
Caught on tape, a black man pinned to the ground, later dying after a white officer kneeled on his neck.
It started with a report of a forgery in progress and ended with Floyd's death.
The situation has become volatile at the 3rd Police Precinct tonight.
As police officers and protesters clash over a man's death.
Miles from Minneapolis, anger, frustration pouring into the streets of America.
I can't breathe!
It all stems from this video.
And you can pick up that entire thing. It's called The Real Timeline, and you can get it at Movies Plus. I'll be back. We're going to take our break. Ken Thornburg joins me right after this brief break.